Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. Dr. Alvin Schmidt joins us. We're going to conclude today in an hour-long conversation our 11-part series on Islam. We've been doing this every weekday with Dr. Schmidt for some time now. Today we're going to round it all off. We're going to summarize much of what we've been saying during this series with Dr. Schmidt, talking about political correctness, multiculturalism, and responding to Islamic apologists, those who are defending Islam, especially after September 11th, 2001. Now, we'll be hearing from one of those apologists a little bit later in the hour. I invite your questions and your comments. This is our final in this series, and that means we will open the phone lines for all your questions and comments of a general nature about Islam, anything specific that you did or didn't hear you'd like to react to, or any question. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. In just a moment, we'll have Dr. Schmidt with us. Then, in the third hour of the program, Uwe Simonetto joins us for our religion roundup. One of the things we will be talking about is the notion about Islam's character in Western Europe as opposed to America. Western Europeans tend to think that Americans are somewhat naive about this, and we'll hear that from Uwe Simonetto, religion editor for United Press, in the third hour of the program. Our call-in numbers again, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, and he's author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Let's talk about political correctness, and in particular, something that I know that you have written extensively about, and that is multiculturalism. Explain to us what this philosophy is and why it has contributed to the skewed picture that we have here in America of Islam.
Yes, multiculturalism, of course, is an anti-Western, anti-Christian philosophy. It's a leftist political ideology tainted with a lot of Marxism philosophies and the like. But the basic point is that it also, as a result, argues that all cultures are equal, and there is no culture that is inferior or superior to another, regardless of what the facts of history might show. So it's become a very strong left-wing political philosophy to basically go against what the West has accomplished, and much of that was what the West has accomplished has been the result of Christian influence. And so this then obviously fits in well with the people who say, for example, Islam is a religion of peace, contrary to what 1,400 years of history show, contrary to what the Quran says, contrary to what the Hadith says, and contrary to what the Sharia says. To say that Islam is a religion of peace, one simply has to ignore all those facts, and those people who say it, for the most part, I cannot believe that they believe their own words.
Now, this also goes along with political correctness, and that is the mindset that to evaluate or to critique something like Islam in negative terms is automatically out of bounds, because that would violate our, really, the what has become the single commandment that governs Western culture, tolerance, or a false tolerance, which is really approval just disguised as tolerance.
Yes, because political correctness is really, in my book that I published a few years ago, The Menace of Multiculturalism, I call it the Gestapo of Multiculturalism. It's the police, the enforcer of multiculturalism. And it's become a very strong, what shall I call it, ethic in our society today. It pervades the mass media. It pervades teaching in the grade schools and high schools and universities and the like. And anyone who questions it is immediately called by some negative term or name, such as a bigot, or worse, maybe a racist. And who wants to have those names called, even if it isn't true? So people clam up and say nothing. And at the same time, these people get away with their blatant exaggerations and many times downright lies relative to what the facts of history show. And that's a major tragedy.
You have mentioned several times in the course of our conversation, we've talked about a lot of these subjects in this series, that there's been both silence on the part of Muslims in general and Muslim apologists in particular, but there has been some apologetic efforts mounted by those who want to defend Islam and maintain the idea that it's a religion of peace, that it's essentially innocuous, that it doesn't do harm both to its adherents or mean harm to others. One of those apologists, Vincent Cornell, was recently interviewed, and he's a professor of history and director of the King Fahd Center for Middle East and Islamic Studies at the University of Arkansas. This is what Vincent Cornell had to say, and I'd like your response, about the connection of Islam to violence.
Well, where do you start with the violence? In a sense, the question is phrased in the wrong way. What is it about Islam that makes it violent? You know, Islam is whatever Muslims make it. If they want to make it violent, it's violent. If they want to make it peaceful, it's peaceful.
Is this true, Dr. Schmidt?
No, it isn't true. It's just another one of these false statements. Islam is not what Muslims make it. Islam is what, for example, the Quran teaches, the Hadith teaches, and as it is enforced in Muslim countries by Sharia law. And Muslims go along with it. I had an individual in an interview with another radio station a few days ago that called from a city who is a Muslim. He said, "Dr. Schmidt, what you say, I would like to believe I am a Muslim," he said. "I've been here in this country for 40 years. I can't remember what he said. I have, however, never read the Quran." And he says, "I do believe you're correct, that if I were even to question the things I'm saying with you on the radio right now, if I were in a Muslim country, the least would happen to me would be imprisoned, if not executed." I says, "You're exactly right." And I also encourage him. I says, "Well, why don't you read the Quran?" You see, and so it's not what Muslims make it, not at all. So if I were to take that phrase literally, and one can, then Islam is indeed what Muslims make it. The Al-Qaeda, for example, and all these other groups that are fostered by the Wahhabism philosophy that basically comes out of Saudi Arabia. So no, it's not true. And moreover, it's not true when you look at the facts of history. In addition to the Quran, in addition to the Hadith, how do you explain the massive violence that existed from the time of Muhammad on, including himself? And I have mentioned in a previous interview, but I think it bears repeating, that within less than 100 years after Muhammad died, they had conquered all the countries east of the Mediterranean, the northern part of Africa, and in 711 invaded Spain and occupied it for for almost 800 years. In the meantime, when they were in Spain, they killed hundreds and thousands of Christians and Jews, destroyed churches, who knows how many. And just to give an example, when in 711, right after the invasion of the Moors, the Muslim Moors from northwestern Africa invaded Spain, a fellow by the name of Tariq Izad, basically sort of functioning as a general, captured a number of prisoners, killed them, cut the flesh off their bones, boiled them in a cauldron, then released the other prisoners, now go spread the word what will happen to you. Now, this is not just an exception. Similar things happened right under or with Muhammad when he had individuals decapitated, and they brought the head to him, tossed him at his feet, and then he praised Allah for what had happened. When one of his individuals went at night to do a favor for Muslim because he didn't like a given poetess, he went at night when she was asleep, had a baby on her breast, pushed the breast aside, stabbed her with the sword, and then came back, and again, Muhammad praised him. So how can one deny all these existing things? It's only if people don't know.
You mentioned Wahhabism. Vincent Cornell, a Muslim himself, and also an apologist for Islam, he blames Wahhabism for Islam's current character. Here's what he has to say.
"Now today, through the influence of Wahhabi doctrine, which has been disseminated throughout the world, partly as a result of petrodollars, partly as a result of the creation of organizations such as the Islamic World League, partly through alliances between Saudi Arabia, not so much the government of Saudi Arabia, but the Wahhabi intelligentsia of Saudi Arabia, along with groups such as the Muslim Brotherhood, this literalistic sort of corporate form versus content view of religion has become more widespread than it ever was in the history of Islam."
Now, is this true? Is Wahhabism, which is a recent occurrence in Islam, as Dr. Cornell points out, is it kind of the aberration in Islam as he wishes to characterize it?
Two things. No, it's not all that recent. It's over 150 years old. long before we bought any oil from Saudi Arabia. So there's a big fallacy right there. And no, you might say it's not an aberration. It is that group that take the Quran and the Hadith seriously. And that simply cannot be denied.
He said literalistically, and I think he's trying to say, look, and he says elsewhere in this interview as I listen to it, that, look, Islam can't take all of the Quran literally. And he kind of appears to want to pick and choose between those parts that Muslims ought to take literally and ought not to take literally.
Well, again, that's how shall I respond? At best, wishful thinking, if I may say that. Any good Muslim that will not take the Quran seriously in a Muslim country is in trouble, in deep trouble. You have to take it literally what it says. There is no solution. He is, again, hiding under a Western aberration as how some people look at Scripture and don't, the Bible, that is, and don't take it literally. It doesn't wash, for example, in Muslim circles. So it's simply not true.
Here he is again in answer to the question. This is Vincent Cornell, in answer to the question of whether or not recent beheadings that we have been horrified by are actually native to the religion of Islam.
Today, Muslims are infamous for cutting off people's heads. Well, in the past, this didn't happen. It's a cultural practice that's become Islamized. This is not a medieval response. This is new. Cutting off the heads of people is a practice that most likely has migrated to Iraq through the influence of the revolt that had been going on for the past 20 years since essentially since the late 1980s, but especially since the beginning of 1990s in Algeria.
Is this true that beheading is unknown in Islam prior to an Algerian conflict?
No, I just said a little while ago, but let me illustrate. If someone wants to look at my book on page 17, let me counter to what he said. Qab ibn al-Sharaf, a half-Jew from Medina, one of 80 accompanying Assad assassinations that occurred under Muhammad. Then when Qab's head, severed head, was cast at the feet of Muhammad with a loud cry, Allah is great, and the Prophet heartily agreed. And I document this with a scholarly footnote. After the Battle of Badr, two prisoners were singled out for execution. One of them, Uqba, asked Muhammad why he was to be executed. Muhammad told him it was because of his enmity to Allah and his prophet. The concerned prisoner asked what would happen to his little daughter after his execution. Muhammad replied, hellfire, as the victim was hewn to the ground. Wretched and persecutor, he continued, scorner of God, of his prophet, and of his word, I thank the Lord who hath comforted mine eyes by thy death. End of quote. No, the decapitations that we see are, you know, obviously have always been part of Islam. This is why the curved sword is so important. And why did Muhammad himself say, I am the last of the prophets and am sent with the sword? He didn't just have it in the sheath for decoration.
Then the subject naturally comes up of so-called suicide bombings. One might also call them homicide bombings, that were rather popular in Palestine until recently, now in Iraq are becoming more and more popular there among Islam and the Islamic population. This is how Vincent Cornell responds to whether or not suicide bombings and this kind of quote-unquote martyrdom is native to Islam.
You cannot be a martyr by choice. This is extremely important. God chooses the martyr. The martyr doesn't choose martyrdom. This is a fundamental mistake that's made by suicide bombers in Islam. Okay, the very fact that they say, I'm going to go and die as a martyr so that people can see me as brave, or because I want to do something for Palestine, or because my family's going to get money, all of these things are illegitimate causes of martyrdom. What is advocated in all of the rules about jihad, or in this case, let's call it holy war in Islam, are that the martyr is a person who acts bravely and selflessly without thought for harm of himself. But whether or not he dies is God's choice. It's not his choice or her choice. Also, the traditions of Islamic law are very explicit in saying that the only acceptable targets of what we would call near-suicide operations are military targets. They cannot be civilians. They cannot be random people.
Now, it sounds to me like a bit of a mixed message. It sounds as though he's saying that the kind of suicide bombing would never have been tolerated in true Islam. And then he starts talking about the targets of what he calls near-suicide operations.
Yeah, exactly right. And, for example, what do you do with Muhammad's own statement, for example, when he says, I would love to be martyred in Allah's cause and come to life and then get martyred and then come back to life and then get martyred and then get resurrected and then get martyred again. This is out of the Hadith. What do you do about the Quran statement in the fourth chapter of fourth surah? And whoever flies in Allah's way, he will find on earth many a place of refuge and abundant resources, and whoever goes forth from his house flying to Allah and his apostle, and then death overtakes him, his reward is indeed with all, and Allah is forgiving. There is another passage that has encouraged the people to, like Muhammad Attaf, to fly the plane as a missile into the World Trade Centers. And then, according to the Hadith, they are promised, and even to some extent in the Quran, they will then be in paradise, the Muslim Islamic word for heaven, where they will be consorting with brown-eyed virgins, huras, H-U-R-I-S. This is what's encouraged the people to become suicidal. And I might also add that the military targets that he's talking about, that's not stated anywhere in the Quran. Or broadly interpreted, a military targets ultimately any group that is perceived to be non-Muslim and hence an enemy of Islam. Moreover, I'd like to say, what will he do or can he do with the two concepts that we've mentioned before, at least once, I think? The basic concept of Dar al-Islam, which means the house or the field of peace, in other words, where Islam is and where Muslims live, versus the Dar al-Harb, the house or field of war, the non-Muslim world that must be conquered. Now, this is basic doctrine in Islamic theology. He's obviously clearly ignoring all these. You know, a few years ago in 1999, the book was published. I cited in the book. And then a year or two later, the University of North Carolina required all freshmen to read this particular book about the Quran. Now, I've read that book. There isn't one statement in that entire book that gives any clue that Islam might have engaged in the past in violence or even advocating it now. And I might also add, it needs to remember the violent passages that are in the Quran, in the Hadith, are all in the present tense, not in the past tense. And that, again, makes a great deal of difference. And so what this individual is saying simply doesn't correspond to the facts. It doesn't correspond to the own literature of the Muslims, the Quran, the Hadith, and the Sharia.
We're talking with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, and author of the book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. This is the conclusion of our 11-part daily series on Islam. Today we're taking an entire hour in order to leave enough room for your questions and your comments. Our call-in number is 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Doing a bit of response to the Muslim apologists, the arguments being made out there in the public square, in favor of Islam and the notions that Islam is a religion of peace, that basically what it is plagued with is kind of a radical minority that is giving Islam a bad name. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is our guest. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Here again is Vincent Cornell, Dr. Schmidt. He is a Muslim and professor of history and director of the King Fahd Center for the Middle East and Islamic Studies at the University of Arkansas, which I should mention, by the way, the King Fahd Center is endowed by the Saudi government. He is responding to the question, is Islam historically a religion that poses a threat to others?
The danger that Islam presents to many people is a particular danger that I think it's real, it's a threat, it should not be minimized, but it's particularly a phenomenon of the times we live in today, the early 21st century.
Is that true? Is terrorism in its connection to Islam simply a 21st century phenomenon?
No. May I just cite what I said about 10 minutes ago, when, for example, Tariq Zayed in Spain took those prisoners, a number of them, killed them, cut off their flesh, boiled in a cauldron. If that isn't terrorism back at the very beginning, the first century of Islam, I don't know what would qualify it to be terrorism. No, it's not new at all.
And finally, here's Vincent Cornell again, and he is essentially responding to all of that we've been talking about here so far. The misperception, what he would consider a misperception of Islam. He says the real problem is that Islam is simply stuck in the past.
The Muslim world is suffering from centuries of tradition that may have been relevant and may have worked when the world was a smaller place and a less dangerous place. In the Middle Ages, for example, where people didn't travel as much and they didn't have access to other cultures the way they do now, it was easy to be narrow-minded, to consider oneself the best and sort of ignore other cultures. Today, we can't do that. We're thrust together in ways that we haven't been thrust together before. We have a whole array of weapons that now are dangerous enough to lead to the ultimate destruction of human life on Earth. Muslims cannot really afford to be narrow-minded. Muslims cannot afford to erect barriers between themselves and others.
Dr. Schmidt, your response.
Well, I would agree. It's one of the best statements ever made. And if whether he realizes or not, he's also implicated himself by saying, for example, he silently admitted that they were given to violence. He didn't use those words, but he's saying they have to, if they're stuck in the past, what were they stuck with? They were stuck with violence, but of course, it's not just the past. It is still present today, and we know it. We see it, for example, in every Islamic country. And so, in a sense, I would agree they should come out of the past, but how are they going to do that if they continue to see the Quran as the literal embodiment of God's word, and likewise with the Hadith? And if anybody questions it in any Muslim circle, he puts his life on the line. How are you going to get out of this being stuck, so to speak? In a sense, that latter part makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't make any sense given the philosophy and the religion that they lean on. And as I said, basically, the early part of his last statement now admits what I have just been saying earlier.
Folks, you can purchase this book by Dr. Alvin Schmidt, our guest, called The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West at Amazon.com. Or by calling 1-800-636-2470. That's the phone number, toll-free, for Regina Orthodox Press. They publish The Great Divide by Dr. Alvin Schmidt. 1-800-636-2470. From now until October 15th, it's being offered for 25% off the regular price. 1-800-636-2470. It's called The Great Divide by Dr. Alvin Schmidt. He's our guest here in the conclusion of our 11-part series on Islam. We're talking about Muslim apologists here in this last part. When we come back from this break, I'd like your questions and your comments, your phone calls, in conclusion to our series, anything we haven't covered that you'd like to answer, or if you've missed a part of our series and would like a question answered, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Alvin Schmidt is Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois. In 25 minutes, Uwe Simonetto of United Press International joins us for our religion roundup.
The radio voice of the Lutheran faith for the 21st century. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Remembering the rich history of the Christian Church, it is the year of our Lord, 325. The First Council of Nicaea is convened by Constantine the Great, Emperor of Rome. By this time, there were some 1,800 bishops scattered throughout the Roman Empire. 318 of them attended the Council of Nicaea in an ancient city of Bithynia in Asia Minor, or modern Turkey. Their task was to address the Arian heresy, a false teaching traced to an Alexandrian priest named Arius that denied the essential divinity of Christ. One of the results of the council was the adoption of what is now known as the Nicene Creed, an affirmation that Jesus was of the same divine nature as the Father. Arianism was rejected, and the Nicene Creed, along with the Apostles' Creed and the Athanasian Creed, remain as the three great so-called ecumenical creeds of the Church. The First Council of Nicaea, convened in 325, in the year of our Lord.
Show how much you appreciate your pastor by nominating him to receive a gift package from AM 850 KFUO, in honor of Pastor Appreciation Month. AM 850 KFUO has assembled a $100 gift certificate for elegant dining at Kimo's Restaurant downtown. Four St. Louis Symphony tickets, a beautiful bouquet of flowers for the missus from Grim Cruzy Florist in South County, and a complimentary Church of the Week package on AM 850 KFUO. Listen for the church bell sounder. That's your cue to call and nominate your pastor. Only one nomination per listener, please. You may tell a friend or several to call in and register your pastor's name. We'll have a random drawing from all entries and announce the winner on Wednesday, October 20th. Listen for the church bells and call us at 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. It's Pastor Appreciation Month on AM 850 KFUO.
In 1521, at the Diet of Worms, Martin Luther was asked to recant his writings. Luther responded, "Unless I am convinced from the sacred scriptures that I am in error, I cannot and will not recant. Here I stand. I cannot do otherwise. God help me." Will you stand with us as we proclaim these Reformation truths into the 21st century? You can take your stand by becoming a monthly contributor to Issues, etc. To find out how you can become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, check out page 8 of the latest Issues Etc. journal, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. Help us proclaim the solas of the Reformation, grace, faith, scripture, for the sake of Christ alone. Here we stand, Issues Etc. and you.
Domestic violence takes on many different forms.
On the next Focus on the Family.
But generally, it's any pattern of coercive or threatening behavior that causes the victim to change the way she lives.
Dr. James Dobson and a panel of guests approach the sensitive subject of domestic abuse. Hear from women who've experienced it and how God has set them free. It's a broadcast for mature audiences. Next time on Focus on the Family.
Weekdays at 9:30 on AM 850 KFUO.
The literary work, The Renaissance and Reformation Movements, is our Issues Etc. book of the month for October. It's written by the late Dr. Lewis Spitz, a former history professor at Stanford University. The Renaissance and Reformation Movements is published by Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. Or you can browse before you buy, issuesetc.org. Click the What's New section. The Renaissance and Reformation Movements, the book of the month for October. An hour from now, we're going to be talking with Helen Hull Hitchcock of, Families for Faith or Faith for Families? Women for Faith and Family, a Roman Catholic organization, about recent statements made, and this was in the press. I was watching this intently over the weekend. Archbishop Raymond Burke here in the St. Louis Archdiocese making some statements. We'll find out exactly what the bishop is saying. He's reiterating some of his previous statements on the whole lawmaker issue, and we'll talk about that with Helen Hull Hitchcock in about an hour. In 25 minutes, Uwe C. Minetto joins us for our religion roundup. For the next 25 minutes, we're concluding our 11-part series on Islam with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, author of the book, The Great Divide. We're just kind of doing the potpourri now here in this last 25 minutes. Your questions and your comments are welcome, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I wanted to pick up on something that was said right before the break, Dr. Schmidt, and that is, if it is true, as Vincent Cornell asserted there in that soundbite we heard last, that Islam is mired in the past with a bunch of traditions that are no longer useful in the 21st century with global communication and global warfare, if this is true, then what does that say about Islam as a religion? It sounds like he's arguing that it really Islam must change now and stop being what it was before. How can you defend Islam as it was if you say that what it was deficient and it has to change to keep up with the times?
That's right. That's why I said, in essence, he admitted what I was saying, that it's not the religion of peace, because what's it going to change from? It's got to change from a posture of violence to one of peace or less violence. And so he, in essence, admitted what he earlier denied in the statements he made. It's really, you know, you might see a contradiction, but I'd like to say one or two more things relative to what we said before, what we were talking about earlier. there is a person by the name of C, initial C, Iqbal, a Muslim who has been in this country for over 35 years. I quote him in the book. And he recently said, quote, "I will not deny that the Quran promotes violence against non-Muslims and that history proves it. I feel that it is stupid to lie, justify, or defend something which is not acceptable by the standard of today's civilized and human rights." The Kaner brothers, Ergun Kaner and his brother, wrote a book a few years ago about Islam Unveiled, they mention in a statement in their book, violence and war is not a sidebar of Islamic history. Well, there you have it again. And this is, I guess, what he was sort of now admitting was tongue-in-cheek, that Islam has to change from. And I would agree, it has to change from that. But can it? Will it? Well, the best predictor of the future is an old saying, is the past.
What picture are children... children in elementary, middle, and high school receiving now in the classroom of Islam?
Well, for example, in Byron, California, a couple of years ago, in a grade school, children were asked to dress up as Muslims, wear Muslim garb, and say a Muslim prayer, all in the name of, wanting to be multicultural. Now, a tremendous irony here and a contradiction. If any public school in this country required kids to dress up, simply just coming to school and wearing a Christian cross to somehow teach about Christianity, the American Civil Liberties Union would go crazy. But here the American Civil Liberties Union said absolutely nothing. I document this and discuss this at some degree, and this is not the only place. They have had other places where individuals, even in high schools, have enacted being Muslims and the like somehow to, I suppose, role play and become sensitive to them. And again, this is very contrary to what would be permitted relative to promoting Christianity or just saying something about it. In most of our schools, a teacher cannot even have a Bible lying on her desk or his desk, may not wear, for example, a cross. Many of the school children in different parts of the country, and I document this already back in my Menace of Multiculturalism book, literally teachers would go up and snip off their necklace that had a cross on it. And so you see a tremendous inconsistency again, and you're going back to what you were beginning at the early part of the program, how a lot of this stuff is related to multiculturalism and political correctness. And as I have often said, the American Civil Liberties Union, in its so-called argument that certain things violate the church and state separation, was simply a ruse, and now we know it is a ruse. It was basically an attempt on American Civil Liberties Union to in-your-face Christianity, to fight Christianity and remove it from our cultural scene, because now we see when, for example, the Islam religion is tolerated in schools and may be taught, not only taught, but even children dress up as it. We know that they're not serious about separation of church and state. It's really getting rid of Christianity. And so you see multiculturalism, political correctness again in full force.
What would an honest biography of the Prophet Muhammad reveal?
Would reveal that he was, as I point out in my first chapter, a man that was polar opposite to anything and everything that Jesus Christ did. He was a man who was given to violence. He was a man who had multiple wives. He was a man who, for example, engaged in capturing people, enslaving them. Some of his concubines were slaves. He was a man, for example, who had no qualms in swinging the sword. He killed some people himself. It can be documented. He, for example, was a man who was quick to, for example, have others do and act in violence for him. And here's a statement out of the Hadith: whoever changes his Islamic religion, then kill him. By the way, the Hadith makes that statement twice. It says it in another place, slightly different, but basically very much the same message. And as a result of that, for example, George Sale in the mid-1700s, the man who first translated the Quran into English in 1734, said any country might blush to have produced such a monster. Well, these are just some examples. And he broke up marriages, for example. He had no qualms in doing that. If he liked a woman, she looked good to him, he broke up the marriage and took her as his wife. And if she didn't want to become his wife, well, she became his concubine. And again, I document some of those cases in the book. And by the way, I don't know of any informed Muslim who will deny it.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We invite your questions and your comments as we conclude our 11-part series on Islam with Dr. Alvin Schmidt. Let's talk with Stan, who's calling from his car. Stan, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yeah, thank you, Pastor. I was listening to a tape. I believe the man's name was Robert Morey, and he said that, I'd like to know if it's true, he said the imams can lie all they want to the infidels about Islam because of the precedent set by Muhammad in signing a treaty with, I believe it was the Quraysh tribe,
yeah,
and then breaking the treaty and killing it. Is that true? They can just go ahead and lie whatever they want as long as they don't badmouth Allah?
Todd, maybe you can help me. I didn't hear the whole question, every word of it. Could you maybe re-summarize it?
Well, he referenced Bob Morey, who had made a statement that Muslims feel as though lying to so-called infidels, non-Muslims, is permissible because they have an example of that in Muhammad's treaty with a certain tribe.
Oh, yeah, of course. That's very, very true. And this is a basic philosophy of the end justifying the means. And yes, he's quite right. What he's saying about that case is true, and that's not the only time it happened. It happened other times. Yeah, in terms of Muhammad's goals, whatever it took to accomplish a certain end, it was done. And this is just one more example.
We have another listener who's on the line in St. Charles. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, I'm agreeing with your program entirely. The good news is the war in Iraq opened the door for the gospel, and they're being born again by the hundreds because they have satellite dishes and computers. They're asking for Bibles. Islam is not the fastest growing religion in the world. Christianity is. And the other thing about their world domination, they say first the Saturday people, then the Sunday people. So we're next, if they would get their way, which they won't.
Thank you very much. What about the several points that the caller brought up? First of all, the war in Iraq as an opening of the door to the preaching of the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Well, that would be a great thing. I don't know a great deal about that. In fact, sometimes that has happened with a lot of wars, evil as they are. Good comes out of it. God has a way of doing that. And if that's the case there, and she may know a lot more about it than I do, I would say it's a good and wholesome byproduct.
Is Islam the fastest growing religion?
Depending where you talk about it. In this country, no. In this country, it's Mormons. Is it in the world? Probably. But then the question immediately has to be asked, grown by what means? By persuasion, force, or fear?
What about also the rate of production in the Western world? We're barely at replacement rates with regard to population. The Islamic world is much higher than that. Does that account for the growth of Islam?
Muslims do not practice birth control, and so you have large families. And that is, of course, another way it is growing, because only about 10 years ago, 15 years ago, Muslims were barely 1 billion in the world. Now they are 1 billion and a fifth, or 1.2 billion. So, yes, a lot of the growth, most of the growth, has to do with a high birth population. And then, of course, again, you have to look at it regionally. In Western Europe, they're growing largely because of a large birth rate and a large immigration rate. People coming from Northern Africa, coming from Pakistan and other Muslim countries into Western Europe. Turkey, for example, in Germany, most of them have come from Turkey. And Pakistan, most of them have gone to England, but they're also migrating to Italy as well as France. France's population today is roughly 10% Muslim out of the 60 million people in France. It's fast growing, but as I said, and we have to remember, by what means? Persuasion? Or is it the result of a birth rate plus fear and intimidation?
The caller also mentioned Saturday people and Sunday people, I think a reference to Jews and Christians,
right,
as the target of domination on the part of worldwide Islam.
Mm-hmm.
You write briefly in your last chapter about the anti-Semitism of Muhammad in particular. Tell us about that.
Yes, he was ridden with anti-Semitism. And these statements are even in the Quran, for example, the anti-Semitic statements. He fought the Jews, and he, for example, to give a little history about it, initially, when he was still not in total control, he thought he would gain the Jews. You know, Mohammedans have what they call a Qibla. Qibla is the direction you're supposed to face when you pray. That direction today is Mecca. But, for example, in the early stages, he tried to make it Jerusalem to attract the Jews. The Jews spurned him. He got very angry at the Jews. They never forgot it. And as a result of that, he switched the Qibla to Mecca. And so every person who prays now is a Muslim, whether it's in this country or elsewhere, the Qibla points to Mecca, or you face that direction, which is in the direction of Mecca. And as another example, in 627, 5 years before he died, when he captured the Quraiza group, the Banu Quraiza group more formally, about 2,000, including men, women, and children, and out of that group were about 700 to 800 men. The women and children were separated, trenches were dug, and the next morning he proceeded, taking 5 and 6 men at a time at the edge of a trench, and decapitated them all. They began in the morning, and it took them till night to finish by torchlight. These were all Jews. Jews, for example, this under Muhammad. Jews were, for example, very often mistreated in Spain. In 1148, there was a massive, and you'll never find this in history book, for example, persecution of the Jews, as well as one earlier than that. And then there were smaller sporadic ones of, you know, Christians and Jews suffered, and this was back in Spain in 1148. And so, yes, and I cite, give some quotes and statements in the last chapter about his being anti-Semitic. And, you know, even in the Quran, there is a statement that you should not make yourself a friend who is either a Jew or a Christian.
We're concluding our 11-part series on Islam. Today we're talking about Muslim apologists, and we're taking your questions and your comments with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dave is calling from St. Charles. Dave, thanks for being patient. Welcome to Issues, Etc.
Yes, Dr. Schmidt, just for historic proportions, I'm sure it's much more severe in Islam than otherwise, but there are other countries that have state religions, like in England, officially it's Anglican, supposedly, and in some countries the country is Lutheran, so they have a state religion, and other religions have to fight for their own space or so on. Can you give some kind of comparison as to the severity of state religions in Islamic as opposed to Catholic or other religions?
Thank you, Dave.
The European countries basically have what we call state churches. That's quite correct. But it's nothing that compares to the state mosque, if I might say, or state religion of Islam in countries like, you know, Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Iran and even Egypt. Nothing like that at all. Basically, what it amounts to in the European countries where the Church of England is the state church and the queen or the king is head of it, which is still true today, but a lot of that is more or less honorific rather than having any force. The religion state churches, or for example, you go to Sweden and Norway, which is supposedly state church run or according to Lutheranism, the church really has no say in terms of directing or instituting political policy. It is more kind of an honor of the past. And another reason that it comes to mind, for example, is that in these state churches, very often some of the churches are supported with tax money that's collected. but it pales, for example, in comparing it to the state religion of the Islamic countries. There's really not much of a comparison there.
One thing that we should add there, and that is that in countries that still have a state religion or a state-sanctioned religion, Great Britain or others, there is still a distinction maintained between the state and the church. Does such a distinction exist in Islamic countries between the mosque and the church? I mean, a mosque and the state.
No, the only country which would come close to it would be Turkey. But none of the other Islamic countries, no, have nothing like it at all.
About 8 minutes left in our conversation with Dr. Alvin Schmidt, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Late in your book, you have a very brief but, I think, telling quote. This was shortly after September 11th in 2001, Wamfisal Hamuda, he was actually at Willow Creek Community Church in South Barrington, Illinois, and this would have been October 2001. He declared this, and I would like to know what he meant and whether or not it's in any sense true. He said, as a Muslim in that gathering at Willow Creek Community Church, we, that is Muslims, believe in Jesus more than you do.
A horrible statement that you... You know, take a deep breath when you see it. Well, let me comment upon it, as I do in the book. No, first of all, it's a blatant lie to say we believe in Jesus more than you do. And he said this in front of a Christian group, which apparently just sat back and took it. Let me illustrate why they don't believe more in Jesus than Christians do, even, I suppose, nominal Christians. First of all, they deny the resurrection. The Quran denies the crucifixion of Jesus Christ, hence it denies the resurrection of Jesus Christ. They never. And secondly, Jesus is indeed often called a prophet, but he's a lesser prophet in comparison to Muhammad. So this is another deceptive statement, and apparently they get away with it because so many of the people who call themselves Christians in the country don't know what it, what Jesus did, even, or for example, how Muslim Islamic teaching denies that Jesus is a prophet whom they believe in more than we do. We believe that Jesus Christ was crucified, rose from the dead, died for the sins of mankind, and that by faith in him and in him alone you will get to heaven. No Muslim believes this. And I might also mention one other thing, which is very important, I think. Muslims never refer to Jesus as Jesus Christ. It is only and always just Jesus. Now, there's a big difference here, because Jesus is, you know, you might say, accenting the humanity of Christ, whereas Christ accents the divinity, the Messiah aspect of Christ. We have even a lot of Protestant churches today, and I see it on televangelists a great deal. You hardly ever hear them say Jesus Christ. It's always Jesus, Jesus, Jesus. Now, it's not totally wrong, but it's not complete. And the Muslims, for example, by saying we believe in Jesus, again, are speaking a language that seems to be very comfortable to Christians, and they get away with it. But no, they don't believe in Jesus more than Christians do. That is just a bold-faced, I have to say, well, a lie.
Bill is calling from his car. Bill, welcome to Issues, Etc.
Thank you. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. My question is in regards to both Jews and Muslims calling Christ a prophet. How can they call him a prophet when he himself said he was the Son of God? Is that not a contradictory statement on both of their parts?
Bill, thank you very much. And if they call him a prophet, Dr. Schmidt, why don't they listen to what he says about himself, if he is indeed a prophet?
Yeah, well, exactly. The Quran and the theology of Islam is full of contradictions, and that is just one. First of all, the Muslims say, for example, that the Bible is corrupted. So if you were to cite some statements that Jesus said, they would say, well, those are corruptions that the Christians brought about in the Bible over the centuries. So again, they will sidestep the question. I don't know what more I can add to it. No, they don't really believe that Jesus was a prophet. Again, I think it's more of a statement to lure Christians into their fold, so to speak, thinking there is not a great deal of difference.
We have only a minute here before we need to conclude. What do you make of that situation that has been repeated in various venues in various forms that we just talked about? A group of Christians inviting a Muslim scholar or imam in to speak, the Muslim will say something to the effect of, you know, we believe in the same God, or we believe in Jesus more than you do. The Christians sit back and politely nod and agree. What do you make of this situation, Dr. Schmidt?
Well,
One minute.
It's very, very unfortunate, you know. And first of all, I have urged, and I always will, for people to read the Quran and also to read the Bible so they could make good points in comparison. I like to maybe sum up here with a word, a short sentence or two that I have in my book on page 231 that was written by a Jewish columnist in Boston, Don Fetter. He's a syndicated columnist. For example, when we hear about the religion of peace in which so many Christians fall for, or that Jesus is honored by them as much as we are, he says the following. Imagine, in 1940, Winston Churchill taking to the airwaves to announce that Nazism was an ideology of peace, which, regrettably, had been perverted by a few fanatics like Hitler and Goebbels. But most of the stormtroopers, the SS men, are fine fellows and your friends and neighbors. He's really saying this is what we're hearing relative to Islam today. Read the Quran, and you'll see, for example, that what you hear in the media when Islam is presented as a religion of peace, it's not there. And you might also ask, please give me one reference. You won't, as a rule, hear any. Why? There aren't any.
Dr. Alvin Schmidt is professor emeritus of sociology at Illinois College in Jacksonville, Illinois, author of the new book, The Great Divide, The Failure of Islam and the Triumph of the West. Dr. Schmidt, thank you very, very much for all of your time that you've devoted to this series on Islam, and thanks for being our guest today.
Well, it was my pleasure being with you, and I'll miss being on again, being on so many times. Well, thank you a lot.
You can purchase Dr. Schmidt's new book, The Great Divide, by visiting Amazon.com. That's Amazon.com. Just look for the book, The Great Divide, by Dr. Alvin Schmidt, or call Regina Orthodox Press at 1-800-636-2470. That's 1-800-636-2470. When we come back from this break, third hour of Issues Etc. today, we're coming to you live this Monday, the 3rd of October. Uwe Simonetta will be our guest for 25 minutes during our religion roundup. We'll talk about the naivete that a lot of Americans have about Islam to kick off our conversation during that religion roundup. Then Helen Hole Hitchcock will join us. We're going to talk about the most recent news from the St. Louis Archdiocese and Bishop Raymond Burke. He was granting interviews again. It is interesting to have an archbishop now who is so, well, he's not only media savvy, but he's willing to take to the airwaves. And we're going to find out what he said recently, reiterating some of his statements about Roman Catholic lawmakers and the life issue. The tagline on the radio during the weekend was that the St. Louis Archbishop said, it is a grave sin to vote for a pro-choice lawmaker. We'll be right back to talk about that in 25 minutes with Helen Hole Hitchcock.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.